Hello and welcome to the Zeitgeist Tapes. We're back! Woo! Hello!
Yes, hello!
We had, as our regular and loyal listeners will know, we had a little bit of a break towards the end of last year. I think 2020 got on top, particularly on top of me. But Zeitgeist Tapes was something that got pushed to the wayside slightly. But we've had a lovely, restful end of 2020 and start of 2021. And now me and Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Emma, and hello, loyal listener.
We are back. And this episode, just to really test how much you've been loyal, we're going to discuss a French film, which we've both watched in subtitles. So there won't be a clip this episode because we're not that mean. But it is The Crime of Monsieur Lang. Steve, this was your choice. Do you want to introduce the film?
Yes, and if I can just apologise to our loyal listener for us breaking the break and for resuming the Zeitgeist Tape. but it is actually the choice of this film, which is my choice. I will take all responsibility for it. Is in fact kind of related to the lockdown situation that we've all found ourselves in, and that was partly, you know, contributing to our little break. I mean, I was absolutely shattered, knackered, and just absolutely bereft of ideas and any thoughts of any kind. And since the start of the new year and the new lockdown, I've done a few things. I've converted to oat milk, not dairy milk. I saw a lovely thing on Twitter with lots of animals being all very cozy with humans. And at that point, I decided I'll just stop eating meat again, right? So I've stopped eating meat again. And then I also thought, I'm kind of fed up watching the same old kind of films, you know. I mean, not that I've got anything against Hollywood films, not that I've got anything against British films, whatever period, I do like them. But I just thought, well, why don't I just start to use this time that I've got to do things which, you know, that I might like to, you know, I wouldn't ordinarily do. And so I thought, first of all, decided I'll start to watch some foreign films because they always make me feel clever. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're reading subtitles, it always makes you feel that you're reading a film which actually is probably cleverer than it really is, really. And also it shows you, you know, it gives you different insights into different kinds of cultures and this and that and the other. So I'll do that. And I watched what was it called? It was the Jean Renoir film, La Grande Illusion, which is a prisoner of war film that he made in the late 1930s. And I'd seen it once or twice. It was familiar to me. And I was just struck by how great it was. You know, the humanity in it. It dealt with anti-Semitism in a really kind of confrontation, you know, in a humane way. There was lots of humour in it. And it was a great story, right? And I thought, well, I've seen this Jean Renoir film a few times. Why don't I start watching more Jean Renoir films, right? So I'd started looking at Amazon Prime because there's a few on there, including the film I'm eventually going to talk about. I've only seen about four or five Jean Renoir films. And I kind of vaguely knew something about him. Our listener might have heard of Jean Renoir. I mean, he's the son of Auguste Renoir, your actual painter. And he started making films in the 1920s into the 1960s. He made films in Hollywood as well as in France. And I mean, he's sometimes seen as the one of the first auteurs, the first, you know, director who's got themes they want to tackle in whatever films they do. They've got a certain way of doing things. And he definitely does. He definitely does have those. And so I started to watch a few of his films. And one of the films that I really enjoy, I mean, I've enjoyed them all, right? The few that I've seen. And I've enjoyed how they deal with politics, but they do it in a very light way with humour. They've got a very, very humanistic approach to relations between men and women. And because it's most of the ones I've seen are from about France in the 30s, about anti-Semitism as well. Sort of very refreshing and quite modern liberalism about them. And just really great films. And if our listener hears this and hasn't really watched a Jean Renoir film, and he listens to this and then he or she thinks, I might watch a Jean Renoir film. I think my work is on. I'm a proselytizer for Jean Renoir, right? So let's finally get to The Crime of Monsieur Long, because also I like French accents. And it was made in 1935, but it came out in 1936, which in France was a very interesting time. In 1936, it was the formation of a Popular Front government that was an alliance between the socialists and the communists and sort of liberal forces and against fascism. Of course, you've got Nazi Germany on the border. You've got the Soviet Union further across the continent. You've got left and right. You've got industrial disputes. You've got all kinds of things going on. And in particular in France. And The Crime of Monsieur Long is, and it's not a spoiler alert because the film starts with us knowing there's been a murder, and that's the crime of Monsieur Long.
And that he did it. I mean, that's never in question, is it?
Oh, yeah, it's never in question. He did it. So really, the question is, was it really a crime, right? I mean, he murdered this person, but was it a crime? And the film kind of takes us through the story and explains how it came to be that Monsieur Long killed Batala, he's a villain of the piece. And there's a kind of court scene where, because the film starts with Long and his mistress, or his, I'm not sure if it's the wife by then, Violette, who they've got a very interesting relationship.
Valentine.
And they turn up at the French border, I think it's with Spain, and they're, you know, and these people in the bar recognise Long as the murderer, and they debate, should we turn him into the police? So she tells them the story, right? And at the end of the film, the people in the bar decide whether it was a crime or not, whether they should help them escape or whether they should turn them into the police. I mean, it's a story on a number of different levels. So it's a love story between Long and Valentine. And there's all kinds of gender things going on as well. We're shown fairly frankly, things you could never have got in a British film until the 50s or the 60s, right? The things that were a bit, how sex is treated in this film, it couldn't have been treated like this in Britain until the new wave of the late 50s, and maybe not even then, right? There's an illegitimate pregnancy. Long goes off with a prostitute, and we're not meant to, you know, feel any, him, look at him any lower. I mean, it's just one of those things. Relationships between men and women are shown in a very kind of ordinary sort of front way. We see Long and Valentine in bed together. I mean, when would you, you know, that you would take a long time for that to happen in a British film. And employers or men with power all seem to be sexually predatory. And horrible, you know, they're using their position, and it's sort of systemic. I mean, he's showing a sort of systemic relations. Again, I don't know where you'd get that in a British film until the 60s, or maybe. But the centrepiece, at least the reason why I thought this was an interesting film about politics, but of course, what I've just talked about is politics, obviously, is it involved a cooperative? Because the man that Long murders, Batala, who is a sleazy kind of swindly employer, who's a publisher. He publishes trash, crime trash kind of weeklies. Doesn't pay his men anything, and he has his secretary, who is also his lover, go off and have sex with one of his creditors to try and get some money. I mean, he's a truly awful person. He apparently dies, and as a consequence of that, all the employees, and Michel Long in particular, who writes stories, he was Arizona Jim, Western stories, ridiculously silly Western stories. They start publishing those. It's very popular. They're a great success. They become a co-op, and the co-op is massively successful and starts to help improve the little kind of courtyard in which it's based. You know, they pay for lights and things like that. And then Batala comes back from the dead, apparently from the dead, and he's going to take it all back. And that's why Long kills him, because the co-op has done all these great things, you know, and Batala is saying, no, it's all mine. To hell with co-ops. You know, they're all ridiculous. And so Long kills him. He murders him. And the story basically concludes that the crime of Monsieur Long is no crime, because Batala was a nuisance. He was a nuisance to women. He was a nuisance to his employees. he was, you know, he's kind of a pantomime employer villain, and he had to die for everyone to be happy. And the people in the bar that I referred to on the border, they say, we're not going to help turn him in. We'll actually help them escape to freedom. And I thought, you know, when I saw that, I thought, this is such a great story with a kind of lefty, progressive kind of an agenda in at many different levels. It's not just about class. It's also about gender. There's a little bit of thing about race, but that's very modest. And various things going on. And I think this is a joyous film, right? And I just wondered also, how would that have been done in Britain? How would Ken Loach have approached the subject? How dreary, how kind of boring, how, you know, and this was done with joy, right? And that's why I thought this maybe is an interesting film to watch. You can tell me, Emma, because I wondered how it might go down. Subtitles, but it was made in 1935, 36. So it's black and white. It's, you know, it's got its own conventions, which you might think were a little bit... I don't know. You tell me. I've spoken far too long.
I enjoyed it. But I found it a bit frothy, if I'm honest. I was surprised that you had found such depths in it, particularly in, because you introduced me to it when you told me we should do it, as a film about a co-op, and it isn't really a film about a co-op at all. It's almost sort of nodded to. It doesn't happen until the last 25 minutes of the film. I was surprised that you kind of zeroed in on that quite so much. It was an interpersonal film as much as anything else. Batala was a ridiculously cartoonish baddie and very fun for that. I would slightly take exception on some of the sexual politics that you raise, because I think, again, probably of its time, but all of the women were used by, but existed through men. Valentine's life was, you know, she left her home to run off with Lang as soon as he'd been killed, as soon as he killed Batala, you know, it didn't seem, and she was, you know, attached to him. Edith, who was the secretary, who, you know, willingly went off to randomly sleep with whoever Batala asked her to, was last seen, Batala having told her to go off with some stranger on the platform because they'll give her money, doing precisely that. She didn't, you know, she wasn't allowed debts. And then there was, of course, Estelle, who was the ingenue and the young and the beautiful and the doe-like and the innocence, and was in love with a sort of fairly equally innocent young man. And it wasn't clear whether she was coerced or slept with Batala willingly or was raped. It was, you know, you weren't clear on that. You weren't, not you, Steve, you, the film.
No, I wasn't clear either, no.
And then she becomes pregnant as a result of this intercourse. And then there's this big celebration because she loses the baby. And I was like, okay. So I'm not entirely sure that the women were as strong feminist role models as you might have made out there.
No, I mean, you have to look at it in the context of the time. Yeah, absolutely. And also, how women were ordinarily represented on the screen. I mean, in Britain and the United States, maybe. And, you know, they were relatively strong women. I mean, you know, in terms of the relationship between Valentine and Long, Long is a wet geek who just fantasizes about, you know, being Arizona Jim. She's the one that kind of drags him into the relationship. She's also, you know, she's got her own business, a laundry business. You know, she's slept with Batala in the past and deeply regrets it and treats him with utter contempt and calls him, I think, in the biggest bastard I ever met, but in French, so it sounds better. In fact, quite a few of the women call him a bastard. A few of the characters call Batala a bastard. She was just called Batala Bastarda or something. So yeah, I mean, they're not perfect feminist icons, but given the time, they are remarkably rounded. But I mean, particularly Valentin, and I thought the critique
Valentin was by far the most rounded of all. So in some ways, you've got Estelle and Edith, who, by the way, look far too much alike. To the point
they do.
The first half of the film, I thought, they're the same person, but is she schizophrenic? And she's just acting so differently with different people.
I think that was deliberate.
When I saw them in a scene together, I was like, oh!
Yeah.
And they are, in some ways, the sort of the dark half and the devil and the angel of how women are generally portrayed. So, you know, you've got femme fatale, no morals, will sleep with anyone.
I don't know if she's got any morals. She's just trapped in a situation. She's in love with Batala, who's a complete bastard, who abandons her. And as you say, he kind of almost suggests she should become a prostitute. I mean, that scene when Batala is, because Batala thinks the police are onto him, so he's going to leave the business behind, and he's going to leave Edith, who's his secretary, behind as well. And he explains to her while he's waiting for his train that I've got this friend. He's a psychiatrist, you know, he's a psychologist. He's a great guy. Oh, he's a bit of a bastard actually, but he knows this man who waits on train platforms. So he can pounce on a woman as at her most vulnerable time, because this guy noticed that when you see a woman waving a handkerchief and she's crying on a train platform, that's when you can get her. That's when she's at her most vulnerable. And then when Batala gets on his train and Edith goes, you know, she's crying, she's waving her handkerchief, and this horrible, you know, man with a pipe, you know, and he's looking her up and down, and he's kind of got, you know, he's not looking at her, he's just looking at her body, and, you know, he knows this is her, and he kind of says, oh, you were crying, oh, and he basically takes, guides her away, and then on that platform, there's loads of other men who are doing exactly the same thing, kind of following her, while the women aren't as rounded as you might want, you know, an ideal feminist sort of hero to be. The men, you know, the critique of how men are with women is, you know, it's not saying this is great.
It's
really criticizing the men for the nature of those relationships in which women are often dependent.
To be honest, what Edith is doing there is having her revenge by being even more predatory. Because it's made quite clear that she's about to leave. Then it turns out that she has to pay Batala's bill at the station. And that's when she kind of flips. And that's when she goes out and waves him off with her handkerchief, something it was quite clear she wasn't going to do previously. But she's now like, right, sod it, I'm going to find my next rich man.
I didn't do that at all.
Do it that way?
No, I saw it that she was utterly bereft. You know, she says, you know, basically says, I love you. And he goes, and Batala's on the train. Oh, yeah, yeah, right. And she's completely bereft and at her lowest and at her most vulnerable. And then this horrible man with a deerstalker, you know, kind of hat on and a pipe, then sort of jumps on her.
I didn't see. There's even a shot of her face where I think it's made quite clear that she knows exactly what she's doing.
Right. Well, I read that very differently, but that doesn't mean. Well, listener, you might want to watch this scene and let us tell us what you think. Yes, that's very interesting.
We have the podcast on Twitter, so do share your views with us on whether you think Edith knows what she's doing.
Yeah. Yes. The whole Edith question, or maybe it's Edith. I don't know how. I forget how her name was pronounced.
I mean, I watched her low enough. I just want to call a stupid woman.
Yes. Yes. So anyway, I think for the time, anyway, irrespective of that particular scene, it's very liberal. It's very you can see women in a light that you couldn't see anywhere else. Mm-hmm. At least, certainly not in Britain. It would have got. I would expect this film to have been banned in Britain. It wouldn't have got a certificate at all. But yeah, it is odd, the celebrations when the baby dies. But that's realistic, though. That means that's inconvenient. Get out of the way. Now good old Estelle can go back with old Charles. and his bike.
Charles the Acrobat.
Charles the Acrobat on his bike, yeah. So, and so it was a kind of a mixture of that kind of sort of liberalism. It was sort of sweet. Some of the scenes are just so sweet and so well constructed. Without, I mean, you're right. It isn't a film about a co-op. It's a film in which a co-op is formed. But given that the whole point of the film is the title, The Crime of Monsieur Long, and we basically discover it was no crime because he basically killed a louse who wanted to take away the co-op. That's a political statement, is it not?
That is a political statement. I mean, it's not one I necessarily concur with. I don't think Lang has the right to make that judgment unilaterally.
No, maybe not. No. Maybe not. But the discussion in that bar at the start, some of the men say, yes, I'm sorry, I'm going into a Gaelic accent now. I don't know why. I dreamt of killing, nuisances. So there's a sense of legitimacy there. But no, I mean, Jean Renoir is not advocating, people going around murdering bad employers, predatory bad employers. But nonetheless, it's kind of saying, we have to sit. Law is one thing, but morality is another.
I thought what was quite interesting was the use of the character who you would now describe as an adult with learning difficulties in the film, who's described as an imbecile in the bar, who is the one A to work out that Lang is Lang and he's the one in the wanted posters. But also, he says we should call the gendarme. Then Valentine comes in and pleads Lang's case. And at the end, everyone else in the bar has changed their mind, but the innocent, as he would have been known then, I mean, I've just read a book called The Innocents, which was one of the two innocents was a young girl with learning difficulties. He is the one who's still a very strict moral code. He's done a crime, you have to call the police. So I thought that was I thought that was interesting framing.
Yeah,
to have him at either end making that argument.
But I thought, I think we're maybe having another, interpretive difference, which is interesting. But that the son of the bartender was presented as an imbecile, or I don't know what the appropriate way would, because I don't know what his problem was, but he was clearly.
Generic term would be adult with learning difficulties.
He's an adult with learning difficulties. But at that time, those kinds of people were treated as idiots, comic foils, fools, literally fools. And I took it, the fact that this kid, because he must be a teenager or something. This kid was shown to be a fool because he wanted to call the police. That he was taking the law literally. And then his father and the other people in the bar were saying, no, this guy hadn't done anything wrong. He's killed a louse. He's killed a nuisance. And to demonstrate how wrong it would be to call the police, they still had the adult with learning difficulties say, no, we've got to still call the police. And I took that to be underlining the illegitimacy of calling the police at that point.
You may well be right in terms of what the mores of the time were. And yeah. I may be putting too modern a spin. Well, I mean, not that modern a spin, because I think we've probably gone through the eyes of an innocent and out the other side of having more respect for people as well-rounded.
Yeah.
But I kind of viewed it as a cinematic way of just putting that completely unjaded position.
Yeah. But I saw that kid as comparable with, the concierge in the courtyard. The concierge who's always going on about his army days, in Tonkin and all of that. And he is the only character to say anything racist. And then as soon as he says that, he's told I forget what the phrase was, but he's got scrambled brains, right? Mm. So it's the only, not that there's any black characters in this film, but he's the only person that says something racist and he's put down straight away. Mm. And he's the only character who, when Estelle's pregnant, and all the women in the laundry, because she works in the laundry, they're all supportive of her. No, there's no criticism of her for getting pregnant. I mean, she might be foolish, but there's no morality. The only person to say anything that is critical along those kind of moral lines is the concierge as well. And the concierge is presented as an idiot, not an actual idiot, but a fool, because he lends Long lots of money, and he's always being screwed over by Long. Yeah, so he's an idiot.
He's a dope.
He's a dope
and a foil. And you have to be pissed and sing Christmas song, even though it's not Christmas.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He's always putting out the rubbish. Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't see them as presenting similar things. He was, in many ways, kind of the idiocy of non-idiots, as it were.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's not.
And that, again, I come back to that framing of innocence that quite often comes along those who are, particularly back in the day.
Well, in a way, actually, isn't Long the innocent? I mean, Long is this dreamer, who at the start of the film, he's just for fun writing in the early hours stories about Arizona regime. He's never been to Arizona or Mexico, but he's fantasizing about it. And then when Batella finds it convenient to publish his stories, he gets him to sign a contract, which means he's signed away absolutely everything. And he's completely oblivious to, to the realities of things. And Long is the idiot. I mean, he's completely otherworldly anyway. And it's only because Batella, apparently dies, and then everything falls into place. And Valentin pushes him into a relationship. I mean, he's the innocent, the kind of innocent that you're talking about, who does this terrible thing, a murder, but he does it for all the right reasons. Maybe he is. Maybe he is. I mean, I thought the Arizona gym stuff was hilarious. I mean, I have to say, I laughed. I mean, the second time I saw it as much as the first time, and there will be a third and a fourth time, I don't know when I watch it, there were some bits in it I was just laughing out loud when they're all posing in the cowboy stuff. I mean, the idea that all these Parisians pretending to be Mexicans and cowboys. It's just so stupid.
It's very silly. Think there was a message in there about, quite an anti-Americanism, or even as Renoir is, as you say, an auteur from the French school, kind of just taking the piss out of American cinema?
No, I mean, that might have been something that would have happened in the 1950s. I mean, Renoir, after the film, he kind of flirted with the communists for a while. But at this point in time, he was described as being someone with a social conscience, but not a socialist. And he went off in the end to Hollywood during the war and made some decent Hollywood films, actually. So I don't think so. But because it's something, I mean, I only knew this out of two sources. When I was an adolescent, I used to read quite a few Hitler biographies. Yes, I know. It's you go through a phase. And when I went interrailing in the very early 80s to Yugoslavia, and in these sort of kind of news agent stands or whatever, there were loads and loads of little books with Western books, all in Serbo-Croat, like Arizona Jim, but in Serbo-Croat. And the reason why I mentioned Hitler is not just totally gratuitous, because you have to always mention Hitler at some point, is that when he was a young boy, Adolf Hitler would read these stories of the Wild West. So these were actually, Arizona Jim might have been a bit of a parody of those kinds of stories, but young boys loved them. And, in the film, it shows you all the boys kind of running to the new edition of Arizona Jim. So I don't think it was that. I mean, there at the start of the film, because Batella is publishing lots of crime, lurid sort of crime stories. And even the men who are printing are calling it, it's just a brainwashing machine. It's all rubbish. What we're doing is rubbish, but people like it, so we're just doing it. That's about as close as you get to a kind of cultural critique, I think, about that kind of thing. But the thing about Renoir, I mean, I've only just started reading a biography of him. I don't know that much about Jean Renoir. I'm no Jean Renoir expert. But there's one thing that seems to come across, and the films exemplify it, and The Crime of Monsieur Long certainly does, is, he has serious themes, but he also has got a stupid sense of, I mean, a silly sense of humour. And it's the way that those things, that this is what I found delightful about the film, is that you could have a film about a co-op. I mean, it is a film in which a co-op is created and the employer is murdered for the good of everybody. And yet you have these some very silly things in it. And it's just having those things together, which I just thought you couldn't really... I mean, I kept thinking, Ken Loach, what would Ken Loach do to this story? And he'd drain all the humanity. I mean, we'd all come out thinking, feeling quite depressed and hopeless about it all. Whereas this film is kind of, there's lots of hope, lots of life, lots of stuff going on. I just thought it was just a great film. Even if you don't think it was very political.
Yeah, I didn't think it was the most political thing we've ever watched. but then, I mean, you know, I've made you an advocate for my point of view that Dirty Dancing is, so, you know.
And it most certainly is. It most certainly is, yes. So,
but yeah, it's definitely worth a watch. Yes. It also passes the Film Flop Friday rule, because it's only an hour and 19 minutes, which is all of, because Film Flop Friday is deliberately watching a bad film, which this is not, I stress to add.
Yes.
One of the criteria by which we judge them is, are they under 100 minutes?
Well, yes, it is short, and it doesn't feel very, it just certainly doesn't feel long. So,
it's very watchable. I found it quite fluffy. I was surprised by how fluffy it was, because I was like, oh, Steve's making me watch a subtitle film. Oh, God, it's going to be really, really grindy. But it wasn't grindy at all.
Oh, the French got a sense of humour shock. Yeah.
there was definitely a lot in there. I think Valentine is a really great character. She's sort of ahead of her time in that certain type of ballsy woman who has clearly made mistakes in her life and is not going to be defined by them.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe on that bombshell, I don't know, you're hosting it. I shouldn't be ending it, but that seems like a good place to end, doesn't it?
It does indeed. A nice short, sharp episode and a short, sharp film to ease our listeners back in to the Zeitgeist tapes. So thank you so much for listening. If you have enjoyed this, please do rate and review us on iTunes or anywhere else that you download this from. And it just leaves me to say thank you to Lord Stuart Wood of Anfield for our theme tune. Thank you to Steve, as always, for joining me. Hello, thank you, Steve.
It wouldn't work. It wouldn't work without you or me, unless you got replacements. That's, you know.
The idea of trying to get a replacement for you every month. Just impossible. Just
irreplaceable, impossible. Yes. And vice versa.
And just to say thank you, and this has been a Political Human Production.